Well, the section that we worked at last week and will continue tonight is a section after the parables where Mark watches Jesus, watches Jesus establish a community that will be his disciples. Because the community of which he was part and for which his mission was mainly directed, on the whole, was not accepting him. And tonight we come to the scene which is at the really turning point of the whole gospel. It's visually quite interesting because it's as far away from Jerusalem as you can get. It's the northernmost part of Galilee, just under the mountain that rises sheer up to Mount Lebanon. It's the source of the Jordan River. It's the beginning of the Holy Land. And just as Jesus turns around and begins his journey now to the cross and the resurrection, which will start tonight, he asks this critical question of his disciples. Matthew chapter 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Jesus said to them, "But you, who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, Kepha in Aramaic. And on this rock, this Petros in Greek, or Kepha, same word in Aramaic, you are Kepha. And on this Kepha, Greek, you are Petra. You are Petros, and on this Petra I will build my church. And the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So the question we open this passage with is, who do people say the Son of Man is? Well, just holding back for a moment from the passage in front of us, I'd like to take you on a small journey and look at what Matthew has already told us in the Gospel in answer to that question. It's not the first time we've asked who he is, and we've received a lot of information already, we, the readers of the Gospel. What's critical about this scene is that here, a disciple in the middle of this whole thing, one who's watched Jesus and walked with him and shared with him and come to know him, a disciple, and typically Peter, the symbol of them all and the leader of them all, Peter makes a wonderful acknowledgement. We'll come back to that. But let's see firstly, and I've given you some notes on this with all of this on it, so you don't have to write it. You can get it later. But I'll just look at it fairly rapidly with you, just to get an overview of what Matthew has already told us. When Jesus calmed the sea, the question was asked in Matthew 8:27, "What sort of man is this? Even the wind and the sea obey him." And later in chapter 9, verse 33, the crowds, we're told, were amazed and said, "Never has anything like this been seen in Israel." John the Baptist in chapter 11, verse 3, asked, "Are you the one who's to come, or are we to wait for another? Who are you?" And in chapter 13, verse 54, "Where did this man get this wisdom?" Ask his own Nazareth people. Where did he get this wisdom and these deeds of power? So the question, who is Jesus, has already echoed through the gospel. What are some of the answers that we already know from Matthew? He's been presented from chapter 1, verse 1, as the son of Abraham, and later as one greater than Jonah or Solomon. He's been presented as the new Moses. He was the one who, "My son came out of Egypt," right in the prologue, led his people on their journey to freedom from the slavery of sin. He's the one who gives the new law. "It was said to you of old, but I say to you," transcending even the great Moses, so we've been told by Matthew. He's the Lord of the Sabbath, that sacred ritual and sacred day which symbolizes the whole of the covenant. Jesus is master of it. Who is he? He's the servant of the Lord, as Moses was. He's been presented right from the beginning of the gospel as the son of David, king of the Jews, the Messiah, the Christ. And particularly dear to Matthew, he is the shepherd of Israel, the shepherd Messiah. "Come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest." The one who has compassion on them because they're harassed like sheep without a shepherd. More than that, already we know, we have been watching the gospel, that he is not simply the glory of Israel, but he's the star that is going to enlighten the whole world. He's the one who welcomes all nations to the messianic banquet, chapter 8, verse 11, from east, west, north, and south. He's the hope of the world. All the world will place their hope in him. Chapter 12, verse 21. Mysteriously, he's already been presented to us as the Son of God. Now, what that means is still a mystery to us today, so it's certainly a mystery in this gospel. But it's a mystery full of light, not a mystery that we can't penetrate. There's too much to see. But it remains an extraordinary mystery which we just keep journeying into. He is the Son of God. He's conceived by the Holy Spirit, we've already learned. He's the one who calls God Father frequently in Matthew. He's Emmanuel, we were told. He's the one in whom God is with us. And in that extraordinary scene of the stilling of the waves, he is the Lord. "Do not be afraid. It is I, ego eimi." The words that echo the tetragrammaton, the Father, four letters, the sacred name, Yahweh. We've learned, and we study this at great length, he's the Son of Man. He's the one who's like us in everything except sin. He's the one who is vindicated by God, and in whom all the poor are vindicated. He's the one who gives God's verdict on the world and to the world. And it's not about the powerful winning, it's about the faithful poor being taken into glory by God. So this Son of Man is a word that of solidarity with the poor, with anyone who wants to be humble and open to God. We've seen him again and again and again as the one who heals, even from sin, and who actually saves from death. We've seen him as one who baptizes with the same spirit with which he was baptized. So as he was overwhelmed by the Spirit, So he does that for other people. Same experience, identical. Gives us his spirit. And we've seen him already as the bridegroom. So there's a lot of lovely material already being presented to us. Now we come to the centre point of the gospel. And this person whom we've been watching and contemplating and drawn to, someone else was very drawn to him and makes a wonderful act of faith in him. Passage again. When Jesus came to the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is? What are the rumours? What's going around?" And they answered, "Well, some are saying you're John the Baptist, and some are saying you're Elijah, and some are saying you're Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." So let's look at that quickly first. We've already seen a close link between John the Baptist and Elijah. And we've studied Elijah in an earlier lecture, so I shan't go through it with you again, except to remind you that in this early times of the Bible, when they had no idea of an afterlife or of life beyond death, they presumed, as the Greeks and Romans and I suppose everyone else did, that we were buried and we went down into this underworld. They called it Hades or Sheol, or different names. Aeneas went down there and to find out what was going on, and plenty of other people did, because people wondered about afterlife and the shades that kind of haunted those caverns of the underworld. That's all they imagined, but not life. Yet Elijah was this fiery prophet. He was too large to kill, so they don't talk about his death. In fact, the legend was that he never did die. A chariot came down from heaven and a fire, and this massive man, bigger than anybody, was swept up to God alive, that equals not yet dead, and he was going to come down in a fiery chariot to introduce the Messiah. That's the story. That's the image. That's the folklore. Well, Matthew 14, verse 2, when Herod saw Jesus and was wondering who he was, he said, "This is John the Baptist. He's been raised from the dead. That's why he's working." So he had this, they were full of these primitive, I suppose, simple fears that the dead might come back and get at you. So Jesus is John the Baptist coming back to get at Herod. However, Jesus himself says, chapter 11, verse 14, when they're asking about Elijah, and is he going to come, is he not going to come, and they're quoting Malachi and all that, Jesus says, "Well, look, if you want to look at it this way, John the Baptist is Elijah. Of course Elijah's not going to come back, but the spirit of Elijah is with John the Baptist." So the reality that's deeper than the folklore is that, yes, God is sending a prophet to introduce the Messiah, and it's John the Baptist. Matthew 17:10, "I tell you, Elijah has already come," and they didn't recognize him. I'm sure you aren't taking that literally, as we're not meant to, but this John the Baptist is the one that people were dreaming about when they dreamed about Elijah coming back. He had the spirit of Elijah. So some thought Jesus was Elijah. Come back. Others thought he was Jeremiah. Matthew's the only one who mentions that. But in the second book of Maccabees, chapter 15, verse 14, we find in there a vision in this quite late material, not long before the Gospels themselves. "Another appeared in a vision, and Onias, the high priest, said, 'This is a man who loves the family of Israel and prays much for the people and the holy city.'" This is Jeremiah, the prophet of God. Why people thought Jesus was Jeremiah, your guess is as good as mine. And I presume Jeremiah was a very sensitive man, a prophet who was rejected, a prophet, however, who was courageous, and a prophet who's clearly very human and very loving. And perhaps other people thought he's a bit more like Jeremiah than he is like Elijah. So perhaps this is Jeremiah coming back, and so on. So that's what the people were thinking, pondering, talking about. Now comes the real question. Jesus said to them, But who do you say I am? A daring question, a risky question. Jesus has come to a point in his life where it seems that he's already prepared now to face the central problem of his whole ministry, to actually go to Jerusalem and try to persuade the religious leaders who are on the whole rejecting him and obstinate in their view of the world and so heavily institutionalized that there's no room for anything new. He has seen that he has to go, love them, challenge them, hopefully reach through to them, but it's a high risk thing. And up till now, it hasn't looked as though it's going to be too successful. So, is he going to go alone? Are they going to come with him? He doesn't want to play around with them. He knows what's ahead of him, in a sense, I suppose. He can sense, intelligent man that he was, what's the likely outcome of this journey. And he wants to know whether they're going to come with him or not. So, it's like asking, do you love me? Who do you say I am? Who am I for you? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. The Butte song used to be out, I don't know if it was 20 or 30 years ago, at least I liked it. I think it was called Annie's Song. I won't sing it for you, but it goes, you fill up my senses like a night in the forest, etc. The word Messiah captures something of that. Excuse me. You fill up my senses. Messiah means anointed one. It's an olfactory image, perfume image. He's saying to Jesus, in a way, you fill up my senses with God. When I see you, I can't help thinking God. When I touch you, I can't help being engaged in this religious experience. When you're around, I feel I'm in a sacred place. All of those things are being said in this very intimate, personal, and quite heartfelt and beautiful statement. You are the Messiah. See, this is not theory anymore. This is you, the real Jesus, who fishes moderately well. Not as good as Peter and the rest of them, though they never seem to catch anything, if you believe the Gospels. But Jesus was a carpenter, not a fisherman, and he was probably a bit awkward in the boat. And that's all right if you're a carpenter. You who, you know, you, whatever you are, this real person, this loving, healing, lonely, I don't know what, all the things that you've seen Jesus to be, you are the Messiah. That's extraordinary. When you think of all the ideas that they were filled with from this high, what the Messiah was going to be. Very powerful, very big, very revealing of the God, you know, that the images are full of. And now you've got this carpenter from Nazareth who seems to be easy to push around in a way. And Pharisees and Herod, and you're the Messiah, Son of the living God. I've also offered you some notes, those who've come late, you can pick them up at half time, you don't need them now. A page or more, I think two pages, where I've given you all the texts where Peter is mentioned in the Gospel of Matthew. Right through the Gospel. Like it's absolutely irrefutable that from Matthew's community point of view, Peter is the leader of the Christian community. It's just abundantly clear. He's called Simon Peter three times. Whenever he's called Simon, he's also called Peter. That's only three times. But he's called Peter, is it 20? I didn't count them. And Peter's the one who comes forward at all the critical points. He's clearly the symbol, the leader, the focal point of the early community in Antioch and in the community of Matthew. Well, it's Peter that steps forth and says, you're the one. When he calls the Messiah, the Son of the living God, that's actually a traditional link, not a common one. In fact, the only three passages in the Old Testament in which it occurs, I've offered you there. And nowhere else in the whole of the Old Testament is an individual ever called a Son of God. Only the king, only the Davidic king, and only in these three passages. But he is called that in these three passages. So, in a sense, the Son of the Living God is a messianic title. Well, here we are. I'll read them for you. The first book of Chronicles. You can also find the parallel passage in the book of Samuel, but I've given you Chronicles here. The first Chronicles, chapter 22, verse 10 reads, "He shall," God speaking to David about his son, Solomon actually, "he shall build a house for my name. He shall be a son to me, and I will be a father to him. And I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever." That's an Egyptian kind of sounding thing, because as you know, the Egyptian pharaoh was the son of Ra, or one of the gods. Ramses means the son. Moses just means son of Ra. Or Tutmoses, the son of Tut, another of the Egyptian gods. Well, the pharaoh was thought to be an incarnation, as it were, of the gods. Not so in these texts. This is an adoption text. At the day of his coronation or consecration as king, the Davidic king becomes not the son in a mythological, anthropological kind of term, but no, he's taken into the family of God and represents him as his son. So that's what Solomon will become on the day of his becoming king. Likewise, Psalm 2, the psalm that was trumpeted forth on the consecration day of the king. "He said to me, 'You are my son today,'" the day of the ceremony, when the prince comes in on his mule and then is put astride a charger, a full-grown horse, and acclaimed with trumpet, and, "Today I have begotten you." Clearly an analogical begetting. Psalm 89, "He shall cry to me, 'You are my Father, my rock, and the rock of my salvation. I will make him my firstborn,'" the Davidic king, "'the highest of the kings of the earth. Forever I will keep my steadfast love for him, and my covenant with him will stand firm. I will establish his line forever and his throne as long as the heavens endure.'" Well, Peter says of Jesus, "You're the Messiah. You're the one whom God has made his son." That's the simplest understanding of the text, and I think the best place to start. In the light of the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, the experience of the early community, and the development in the first three or four centuries of theology, we've come not to an understanding, but to another facet of the sonship of Jesus and God the Father. It's taken us into the mystery that we call the Trinity. And so when we call Jesus Son, we're saying all of that, but we're daring to reach beyond all that into an incredibly mysterious, intimate relationship between the one Jesus called God and Jesus himself. And then come words found only in Matthew. The fact that Peter was the one who held the church together in the post-resurrection period, well, no one with any knowledge of Scripture could possibly doubt that. The evidence is all in the Scriptures. So that's a fact, historical fact. I happen to belong, and many of you do too, to a community that understands history in this way, that actual leadership by Peter of the community was not simply an apostolic fact for the first generation, but when Peter was actually martyred in Rome, though to have a mono-episcopate in Rome doesn't seem to have happened for about 150 or so years. It was the church in Rome seems to have had a number of leaders. It wasn't like we see it now, but that the development of history is one question we can look into. But early in the church, they looked to the leader of the community in Rome as a successor of Peter, because that's where he died. And Rome was the centre of the Christian world at that time, of the world of that time, the European world. So I belong to a community that believes that that function that Peter performed has actually continued in history through the Bishop of Rome. There are other Christians who don't believe that or don't understand history that way. Matthew then puts this scene here, perhaps reading it back into the occasion or seeing that this moment at Caesarea Philippi, whatever Jesus may or may not have actually said then, this was the beginning of Peter's role, which probably only emerged, you know, a year later at the resurrection time. Who knows when it emerged? So he sees in this scene, which Luke and Mark don't, he sees it as the beginning of Peter's role. And so we find Jesus saying, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven," flesh and blood. You didn't get this from reading the books. This is a revelation from God. It's because, Peter, you are close to God that God has enlightened your heart to see who I am. That's what he's saying. It's a prayer insight. "And I tell you," and here we have our text, "you are," I'll give you the Greek if I may, "you are Petros, and on this Petra, on this rock, I will build my church." It's the first time the word has been used in Matthew. It's not used in any of the other Gospels. It's used twice in Matthew. Ecclesia is the Greek. It's the translation of the Kahal, the assembly of God in the Old Testament. So I'm going to build my church. Notice the personal pronoun. That community that assembles around Jesus, as we're still doing here, assembles around him as the renewed Israel, it's called by the Israel of God, Galatians chapter 6, verse 16. Those who from Israel, but also from the whole Gentile world, assemble around Jesus and follow him to the Father. "I'm going to build this community on you, Peter, on this rock. The gates of Hades will not prevail against it." Hades is, we've talked about already, it's the underworld, it's death. It's not hell in the sense of Gehenna, it's a different word. This is the realm of the dead. Well, death's a final thing, it's an awful thing, it's a mystery, well, you know what death is as well as I do, and no one doesn't know much about it, except that it's obviously the ultimate thing that we experience here in our way of thinking and feeling. Well, notice he says, the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He's got the image of a city with gates. Gates don't attack. You attack a city. So the primary image here is the church is on the attack, if I can use such a dreadful military term for what the church is doing. Death itself can't hold out against the church. It's not a ghetto church protecting itself against some strength in the world. The church has got a job to do, and it's to batter down whatever stops light getting in, because people within the city are trapped. They're not powerful. They're actually victims locked into a social setting or a mental framework that's like a prison. The church has a job to do, a mission, to actually laser-like pierce through this stuff and break it open. So that's the image, a powerful, beautiful image Jesus used there. And that won't hold out against the church. Church will go right into death and draw people into life from death. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven." In Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22, as a matter of fact, you read this, talking about David. Isaiah 22, verse 22. "I will place on his shoulder the keys of the house of David. He shall open and no one will shut. He shall shut and no one will open." Well, this binding and loosing, whatever is bound on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever is loose, that just means a complete authority. It was used of the leaders of the synagogue. They could make decisions in law to excommunicate or to welcome, to bind people or to say, no, you needn't do it. So it's a simple word for the authority of someone in the ecclesia, the Jewish ecclesia. And here, because the Christian church was basically organized naturally according to the organization of Judaism, just followed the same thing in Jewish areas, in Antioch, for example. So just as the leader of the synagogue had power to bind and loose, in other words, he had power of authority in the community, so Peter has the same authority from Jesus in this church that he's building. And then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Earlier in chapter 9 we studied that. For those of you who knew, there seem to be two main reasons. One is that Messiah could only be misunderstood without personal discipleship. That's the main point. If people told others that Jesus was the Messiah, those they told could only get the wrong idea. The only way to understand what Messiah means is to look at Jesus. So the best thing they can do is send people to Jesus and let them find out from him who he is, so they won't misrepresent or misunderstand him. It's probable also that Jesus was not wanting to bring on unnecessary conflict.